Hey, Cut to Blackers. We didn't bring it up till the end of the show. We should have brought it up at the top of the show. Just a reminder that you can find the Cut to Black feed on iTunes, and we would greatly appreciate any reviews you could submit, whether you are a subscriber of Cut to Black or shows what you know. Now, on with the show.
You ever feel like nothing good was ever going to happen to you?
Yeah, and nothing did. So what? I'm alive. I'm surviving.
That's it. I don't want to just survive. It says in these movie writing books that every character has an arc. You understand? Like everybody starts out somewheres, then they do something, something gets done to them, changes their life. That's called their arc. Where's my arc? Keanu Reeves, Devil's Advocate. You see that?
How?
Right. Keanu's a lawyer. Gets all turned on by money, power, and the devil. Then his wife says to him, "You're not the man I married." Leaves him. You see the arc? He starts down here. He ends up here. Where's my arc, Paulie?
We've all asked ourselves that at one point of another, especially at our low points. Where is our arc? Welcome to Cut to Black, a Soprano sit-down. I am Jim Scampoli.
I'm Jacob Burrows, and we're here to talk about episode 8. So now that I've seen 8 episodes, I really think I know what's going on. I've learned to read and write and everything because I'm an 8 years old. It's The Legend of Tennessee Moltisanni. Now, the man we just heard speak is Christopher Moltisanni, right?
Correct.
What's the Tennessee in reference to?
Tennessee Williams?
I don't know what that is. There's a lot of references in this episode to Italian stuff that I look forward to you explaining to me, Jim.
Well, Tennessee Williams is an American playwright. I don't even know if he's Italian or not.
He probably was, and if he is, and he wrote shit, didn't he?
The Glass Menagerie. I did read The Glass Menagerie in school, so I do know that. It's about, it's about a woman who is pining away for a gentleman suitor to come and like sweep her off her feet and take her away from her family, and she's obsessed with this glass menagerie. Tennessee Williams, I think, is just a classic like playwright reference, like a writer basically. And there is that scene in this episode where Adriana is fawning over Chris with his terrible script, and says, "You know, you're my Tennessee William," I think she purposely like says it wrong because she's dumb. Not that we're that much cultured. We don't even know who Tennessee Williams is, so
yep. And that was one hell of a screenplay, so we got to give him that.
Well, you know what's great is that Tennessee Williams is also a big are you familiar with Tommy Wiseau and The Room? What's that? The disaster artist. He also likes to pitch himself as a Tennessee Williams. Like he thinks he's on that level. So it's almost like Chris Moltisanni is the original Tommy Wiseau. If only he could just get that movie made, The Room, and become huge and famous.
Well, we don't know. I don't know where his character ends up. As far as I know, that might be exactly where this is going. It's a very Christopher-centric episode. It starts with a dream. We've had quite a few of these now, I feel, dream sequences. This one's a bit more over the top than we've seen previously, because the others have been all like dream imagery, and this one kind of, I mean, obviously it's all dream imagery, but it's all like absurd pig fat being handed over, and he sees the guy he killed, and there's a whirlwind, and like it's such a typical Christopher dream. Like Tony at least has more of a sort of down to earth dream, I think.
I agree with that. It fits, like it works for Christopher, because especially what we're learning, I mean, we've known this a little bit about Chris from even the pilot when he mentions, you know, Hollywood stories and I could sell my story. And now we learn even more that he is kind of this movie buff. He fancies himself a movie buff, and he wants to write a script. And this is one of my favorite aspects of Christopher, because, you know, as we are people that like to create things, so you can relate on this level of, you know, wanting to create something. And so, and then in the same vein that his script is kind of on the nose, so are his dreams in that weird cinematic way.
Yeah, I mean, I felt maybe it went on for a bit longer than I would have liked, just as far as how it fits in. Like, it's several minutes. Like, we immediately almost realize it's a dream, and, like, there's one of everything. It's his girlfriend eating a sausage, like it's a big dick, and then it's Tony's wife eating the sausage,
Carmella.
And the guy in the bag, trash bag, he's got blood on him, and the whirlwind, and like, it's everything. It's everything. I mean, it's fine. As you said, it's that's his character as well. He sees everything. He's very extreme, you know, black and white.
Well, what I like about it is that it's set up as this thing, and even Christopher thinks it's this thing that he thinks it's a warning. And in a lot of shows, it would be like a real warning. Like, you're having these dreams of, like, you made a mistake. You need to go back and stash the body. And the great thing about it is that it doesn't amount to anything, because what the fuck? Like, you're the person you killed, like they even say, the person you kill isn't going to come back to you in your dream and help you and tell you that you made a big mistake.
Yeah, the reason the scene is essential is we're seeing Christopher kind of coming apart a little bit, because, I mean, we need this to set up his state of mind to get into where he's at. Because if he was just, like, writing a script and it wasn't going too well, and then he starts acting weird, the car scene with Tony is, you know, pivotal for everything in this episode, and it wouldn't have made much sense without this. So even though I didn't love the dream sequence, it does make perfect sense.
Yeah, and I agree. Although I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the dream sequence.
Cool. Just felt like something out of Buffy, you know, like to that level of like a hand does a thing, and it did feel a bit weird to me.
Although, and one of my favorite episodes of Buffy is Restless, which is all dream stuff like this.
I know, and I'm also notoriously not fond of dreams and flashbacks, and you're the opposite on those.
Absolutely,
so, yeah, makes sense. We go to this wedding. I don't know who's getting married. It's like one of the Capo's daughters, I think.
Yes, yeah. And I don't even know that Capo's name offhand. Although he is the guy, the actor that plays him is the guy in Goodfellas. He's the guy on the opposite end of... forget it. He's in Goodfellas, but it's not the scene I was thinking of. My bad. He is in Goodfellas, though. He's the one that's like... He keeps coming over to Joe Pesci's character... And, you know, he's trying to bill him, or he's trying to bother him about the tab. And then, of course, he gets beat up for it.
Well, I was perusing the trivia, and I saw that the scene later in the delicatessen was also kind of a Goodfellas reference, where he gets shot in the foot, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. We'll get to that. But yeah, that's for sure mirrors a scene with Michael Imperioli, who plays Christopher.
Right. Right. But we're at the wedding right now,
yes.
And, you know, it's going great. What a lovely affair. But it takes like 1 minute for it all to get totally out of hand, where there's this rumor comes out where there might be federal indictments. I know the English language pretty well. An indictment's when you, like, take someone to court or prison or something?
Basically, yeah, it's kind of like the prelude to charges in a way. Like, it's basically like the formal yes, we've been investigating you, and it doesn't always mean we'll take you in, but it's like one step over from taking you in and basically having to be brought up on charges.
Yeah. So obviously people aren't too happy about this. There's an impromptu meeting where all the Capos hang around, and Tony's, like, everyone's turning to Tony, and Junior is all upset that they're turning to Tony, but, you know, Tony wisely agrees with whatever Junior says and then steers it all towards, but as I'm sure you were going to say, Junior, you think that we should all do some spring cleaning, right? And he's like, yeah, that was my next comment, of course. So everyone rips their wives away from the party. The bride is crying. Everything's going wrong. They take money back, I think, that they gave as a present.
It's such a great moment.
Illegal money.
It's such a great... Well, Big Pussy just takes the money back because he makes that comment of, like, I gave them this much. If I knew I might have to lamb it soon, I wouldn't have given them that much money. So, yeah, then we get a nice shot of him, like, reaching back in the bag and taking his envelope back. Oh, yep. What a great moment.
Yes. So they all head home, and here we also get a nice scene with Tony and Carmilla kind of bonding, reaching up into the rafters and removing guns and money, and then even bigger guns. And yeah, Carmilla's a bit shaken up, but we get the sense here. I mean, usually she's more like, oh, I don't know anything about that business side. Like, she likes to turn a blind eye to it, but that must be kind of tricky when she's being handed the biggest gun and has to put it down somewhere. What did you think of this scene and what's going on with these two characters here?
I love the moment where he has to, like, he's like, give me your jewelry, like, they want receipts. And then there's that small moment about the engagement ring, and yep. You know, the engagement ring's stolen, but he'll let it slide because he does, you know, what's he gonna do, put himself on the spot? And he has to be like, you know, what do you think I am? And it's like, well, we know what you are, you're a criminal.
It's also like, that's not going to be the thing that changes anything. Like, if he goes to jail, it's not going to be because of stealing an engagement ring 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It's going to be, you know, other shit. Well, so he lets it slide.
I want to back it up a little bit and slow it down just a second, to talk about the episode as a whole. Cause I mean, we talked a bit about like the direction and the feel of last week's episode. I feel like this episode is a return to form after like a small hiccup for The Sopranos. I do want to call out that this is the first episode directed by Tim Van Patten, I believe, who goes on to direct, I think, like 20 episodes. Or basically, he directs the most. So by the time the series is done, his fingerprints are on the most episodes out of any other director.
Okay.
He also did go on to direct some episodes of The Wire and Boardwalk Empire. Game of Thrones as well. Yeah, I didn't even know that. So I feel like it should be called out, at least for my opinion. I feel like this is a very solid top-tier episode. And, I mean, the quote that I used at the beginning, it's one of my favorite Sopranos interactions, like, of the whole series.
That's interesting. We'll get to that in a sec. It's obviously like way better than last week's episode. One of the reasons is that it picks up the pace an awful lot. I get the feeling that they sometimes do this whole one episode in between thing where they plant something in one episode, then there's another episode doing something different, and then the thing from two episodes ago slams into the story and kind of takes things off. So we've seen all the FBI pictures and stuff that's already been set up at the funeral and then reinforced with more pictures and the whole cork board putting Junior at the top. So I guess I was kind of expecting, okay, now is when we get to know an FBI characters. It's like tailing them or whatever, and we drag it out. But, I mean, things are definitely happening. They get a whiff of what's going on and start panicking. There's a lot of momentum here, which was lacking a bit last week.
Yeah. And I think, everybody wants the mob stuff. Come on. What are we watching The Sopranos for? We want to see the mob. We want to see the mafia. So it's always nice to kind of check back in with the crew, at least for me anyways. I like taking detours and hanging out with Chris for a while, or hanging out with Paulie. Like, we haven't really gotten a chance to like hang out with Paulie or Silvio that much, but I enjoy that quite a bit. So I'm here for it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the big draw of the show. In fact, in this episode, the only bits that don't feel like they're full of momentum are, you know, Melfi's. I mean, we get to know Melfi's family, which is so weird. I didn't know she had a son. My mind is obviously like, but it's like it doesn't have the same speed to it as the rest. But I think that works in favor. You know, you can't have breakneck speed all the time.
Yeah, I agree. And I know we'll get into it a little bit. And even though I feel like some of the stuff is a little clunky, I love that they do it. I love that they comment on like the hypocritical thing that they're doing. I know it can be a little on the nose, but I enjoy that they're commenting on Italian Americans and the stigma, and even talking about Goodfellas with an actress from Goodfellas, but they're doing the mob show, like they're doing the thing. I usually don't like when things do that, because it's used as an excuse. Like, one of the things that pops to my mind, horrible reference, but Riverdale, when I watched the first episode of Riverdale, they tried to be meta like to make fun of themselves in a way, but just in a way to excuse bad writing. Whereas I think this show, they handle it a lot better.
Yes. Yes. I want to mention one thing before we skip over it, because it's the most important scene in the episode. AJ's still trying to swat that fly.
Yes.
He's still going at it. It's been, I don't even know how many episodes. You bring this kid into a psychiatrist's office. You do all sorts of tests on him. It doesn't really matter, because in the end, all he wants to do is swat that freaking fly. And I know someone, there's an arc here somewhere. Someone thinks this is like Breaking Bad, the fly level shit. But I really think you're right that they just didn't know what he does all day. What does a kid do that's totally useless and that someone would do if they didn't have anything going on in their brain? I guess just keep trying to swat that fly.
Well, it's funny because, you know, I made a big deal about him trying to catch the fly in his earlier episode. I did not realize or remember that it comes up again. And who knows, maybe it even comes up again. And as you said, could be a prelude to the Breaking Bad episode, The Fly. But what a fucking dumb, funny way to check back in with AJ as he's still jumping on his bed trying to catch a fly. And we should call out, as we're recording anyways, happy birthday to Robert Ehrler, the actor that plays AJ Soprano, just turned 33. That's right, whoa. 33, 2 days ago.
Cool. Hopefully he's got that fly by now. So yeah, we have Christopher writing his script. Let me see if I can just get a quick freeze frame. Oh yeah,
get the
Rocco
drip
says,
on him.
I thought I was dead, but I managed to get the drip on him. I guess he means the drop on him.
Yeah.
So you know, he's trying.
Yeah.
He's doing his best.
Well, and I love he has the comment of like, you know, I bought this computer. I thought it would do most of it. Like, and it's so dumb, but that is really how people think. Like, they think they buy a Mac and they'll be able to make a movie, like edit a film easily. Like, oh, I'll just get a Mac. I can do special effects. Get a Mac.
Yeah, it makes you more creative. You know, it makes you a pro. Yeah. It's right there in the name, MacBook Pro.
He accidentally deletes his great dialogue and he's like, the computer ate it again. And she has to come in. Oh, you know, it's just in buffer memory. I don't know if that's a real thing.
I guess I would say, I mean, let's say he hit the delete key and she just hit Control Z. I mean, basically it's in the buffer memory. If you move back and you got it back, I guess. But Christopher's doing all this while everyone is running around. Like, he does this, and then on the TV, he gets a call, right? And on the TV, they're talking about this stuff, and he's so upset that his dead friend is on the TV and he isn't. Like, yeah, Christopher, if you were dead, you would be on the TV. Is that really what you want, though?
I love his envy of his dead friend, and I assume that is kind of the hints at where Tony asks him later, you know, you ever think about, and he does the gunshot to the head. That is kind of a weird suicide connection there, where maybe that's part of it as well. But yeah, just this notoriety, and even because the news gets it wrong, where they're like, known associate, this must have been a power struggle. And it's like, no. I mean, I guess in a way, but they're pitching it as this guy maybe was on his way to the top, and from what we know, the truth, and of course what Christopher knows, he was just a piece of shit, like the biggest piece of shit, and was a weird little message that would cause no real waves with anyone. So I love all this stuff with Christopher being really jealous, and especially because he would bring him around, and it's such a lame thing. Like, people are legit worried that they're going to get arrested, and Christopher is just mad they don't name his name, because he wants that notoriety.
Yeah, because Melfi's watching it, and the Sopranos are watching it. Everyone's watching this on TV. And yeah, I mean, Tony has more of a real, like, real problem to deal with. He is being mentioned, which is actually worse, if you think about it, for literally 1 second. But I guess, oh yeah, no, they don't mention him specifically, but they talk about the Soprano family, and, you know, obviously he made Junior the boss, so everyone, I think someone does say later, like, wow, you really thought this one through, eh? Like, that really paid off real quick, didn't it? Which it did. But we move to a family dinner, and I'm like, who the hell are these people? What is this? Is this rival crime family of another one? Got another family? Who's the capo in this one? But no, it's Melfi's son, and it took me a while to figure out the relations here, but it's Melfi's son, her ex-husband, and her parents?
Yeah, yeah. They're not fully clear on the grandparents on which side it is, but I guess it probably is Melfi's parents, I imagine. Maybe they do make a reference. Maybe she does say Ma or Dad or something. But yeah, it's a nice parallel to, you know, especially even in this episode later on where we see the Sopranos having dinner and have like a similar discussion where there's this idea of kind of the Italians being persecuted as far as in mainstream media and what you think of as far as Italian Americans as you watch this mob show.
Yes, of course. Jim, what's your personal take on the portrayal of Italian Americans in the media? But for reals.
I guess they're making great points. And I mean, it's the same type of discussion we have a lot more nowadays with social media, where we talk a lot about portrayal of different ethnicities in media. So it's right in there. It's the same vein where you do think of Italians as these mafiosos. But what I really like, and I think they spell out in a nice way, is later on when we meet their family therapist, the Jewish guy, and he's kind of like proud of it. And yeah. I feel like that's everyone. Even if you're in like an Italian defamation league and you're one, a big part of your life is to kind of curb this mindset, or any other ethnicity, if you have this weird badass part of it, there's still a part of you that's kind of like, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I was trying to recall like who was saying it in that scene, but I guess his son says that, yeah, but like Goodfellas and Godfather, oh yeah, he cuts in like, yeah, great films. And he's like, well, yeah, they're great films, but it's a great, and everyone thinks of that or pizza. And he's like, great films to eat pizza too. And I think the granddad is like, the Irish never complain about being portrayed as this and that, you know? Yeah, you never saw the Scottish-Irish pissing and moaning about being portrayed as rustlers and gunslingers. And it's almost, as the Jewish guy brings up later, it's almost like, yeah, but it's kind of cool, too. Like, it would be worse, I think, it would feel worse if my people were portrayed as, like, just the wimpiest. Oh, yeah, wait a minute, I'm Swedish. It would be worse if my people were portrayed as, like, the wimpiest people ever. There's that. Or do we go more towards, oh, yeah, the Vikings, you know, oh, it's terrible that everyone talks about how much the Vikings raped and pillaged, but it's kind of awesome, too, right? Like, it's mainly awesome. Yeah. And that's, like, the thing with gangsters. We watch these movies not because we're like, oh, what a terrible person. What a horrible human being. We're like, fuck yeah, I would do that if I could and had the guts.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's that. I like how they kind of portray that attitude where there's always going to be a part of you that's like, that's cool. And especially when it comes to movies and stuff. Yeah, like they mentioned, you know, gangster films are, you know, thought of as classic filmmaking in the vein of Westerns. And it's just, of course, there's a lot of bad gangster films, but some of the best films made would fall into that category. So, you know, and you know, one of the best TV shows made.
Yes. And then we have the scene in the pastry shop where I just know something's bad is going to happen, you know, because of the way it's shot, like where Tony says, go pick up this. And Christopher's like, oh, God damn it. And then we see him go into the place. And I'm like, well, usually you just cut to him arriving. So obviously something dumb's going to happen because it's Christopher. And he gets a thing like a number. What's it called? Little number.
Well, yeah, yeah. When it's like when you go into a deli or, you know, in this case, the pastry shop. You pull a number. And I guess that is another thing I didn't pick up on first viewing, but I, you know, someone pointed out he pulls number 34, and it, like number 34 was in his dream, of course. So there you go. There's a connection. And it's a great reminder that, you know, to us, the audience, and to Christopher himself, that even though, yeah, he killed a guy for their thing, for the family, and he runs with a mob family, what have you, but people don't know him, and he doesn't have that swagger. He doesn't they're not like in Goodfellas. There's a line where Henry Hill mentions that neighborhood kids would carry his mom's groceries home from the store out of respect. So it's like a big thing, especially if you're in the mob. But Christopher doesn't have that. He doesn't have that clout. He waits in line like everyone else, and even when it's his turn, he gets shit on. And so it's just another thing to pile on in Christopher's dumb psyche of not like moving on up like he thinks he should.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say that like I agree with him and that I'm completely on his side, but right up until the point right before he shoots the guy in the foot, he's kind of keeping his cool and he's kind of collected, and he kind of opens the door like, hey, take a walk. And like, I mean, obviously he's pissed off, but he got what he needed from that interaction. And if it was just about the disrespect, that would have been fine. Cause he even says like, next time I show my face here, you show some respect. And he's like, I will. And he's like, okay, now I'm going to shoot you. Like, after he gets that, after he reaches the point where he wants to be, that's the respect he wanted and acquired. And now instead, he's going to be wanted by the cops, because that guy, he probably wouldn't have made a report, or if he did make a report, I mean, if he didn't get shot in the foot, it wouldn't really matter that much, because nothing that bad really happened. But if someone goes to the hospital, it's like, now we're looking for you, and obviously we know your car and everything. So this is where he self-sabotages himself, because there's more going on in his psyche than just worrying about respect.
Yes, yeah, and it should be a quick aside for people on the rewatch or even people on the new watch. When Gino comes in, the guy who like is almost there, like that Christopher tells to take a walk, and he's even like, go ahead, just help him first or whatever, the big fat guy. That actor actually it will be back as a different character, more main character. So it's kind of like a weird little flub. So keep an eye out for more Gino, but maybe as a different character.
Oh, I was perusing, the trivia stuff, but I have to be very careful because I saw stuff like, oh, the wives are portrayed later as blah, 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 because the wives don't have any lines or anything. They just get pulled away at the start. But, like, I see that, and then it's, like, returned as blah, blah, blah in episode blah, blah. And I'm like, ah, scroll.
Yeah.
Because if you didn't catch it at the top, the whole idea is I haven't seen The Sopranos. I have no idea what's going to happen. Yes, this scene, it does mirror a scene in The Goodfellas, or in Goodfellas, right?
I did send you the scene. I don't know if you watched it, but yes, it's Christopher's famous scene in Goodfellas. He plays a young kid by the name of Spider, who is basically just like serving drinks at a poker game. And Joe Pesci's character gets annoyed with him for, you know, forgetting his drink.
Because he didn't show respect.
Yes, basically. And it turns into that thing where he's like, oh, you know, let's see you dance the drinks over here. And he starts swinging the gun around and maybe shooting at his feet. And he mentions like a Western. And then he accidentally shoots him in the foot. So it's like the same, you know, the same thing. But now, you know, Spider's getting his revenge, basically.
Yes. Great for him. And where are we? What happens after that? I mean, he arrives.
Oh, you shot me in the foot. It happens, he says. And then, he shows up at the Bing, and he's being classic Christopher. It's great because in all the episodes leading up to this, we've just seen moments where Christopher comes in from his thing and he's all pissy about something. But now we've been with him on the journey. And so they're like, you know, they're giving him shit for taking a long time, and he throws the box down, and then Paulie's mad because of the brajoule or whatever it is that's in there. And, you know, he's just being Christopher, and they make him go sweep for bugs with the dude that works at the Bing.
Yeah, and just the way he said something, they're in there, and I'm trying to find the line exactly, but Christopher says, they never even would have known that guy if it wasn't for me. I brought him around here. And what does he say? What's his name, that guy? I don't even know what the bartender's name is.
He says something like, I had no idea, or something
like that. I had no idea, and the way he says it makes me think he's an FBI mole, and he's feeding informations and whatnot. That's the impression I get anyway. But the thing would be, if that's the case, they'd be pretty screwed, I guess, because he's in there. He's picking up a lot of stuff. But
is that Georgie? I think it's Georgie.
Yeah, Georgie. But I mean, yeah, I know you can't comment, and probably that's not the case, but I just get the feeling it's one of those lines they put in where, like, he's usually an idiot, but then he's kind of got this look of like, really, I had no idea, like he's putting it away in his memory. Maybe he needs to do that with everything he wants to remember, because that's just who he is, or maybe there's something more going on here. We'll see.
Yeah, we will see. And Christopher kind of hammers it home even more of the, basically how jealous he is of his dead friend. And it is just kind of also a nice visual of he's on his hands and knees in a shitty bathroom, like looking for bugs. So he is he's clearly bottom of the barrel. Like, we kind of see why he has that in his head. He's a bit more like depressive sociopath the way he reacts to it. But yep. There's truth there.
Yes, absolutely. So then Carmilla goes and lures Tony's mom away from the home in an extended sequence, because, of course, Tony's mother would rather stand here and move these pillows back and forth all day than go anywhere without, you know, deciding herself, it seems.
Yeah, and it's great because she's being Livia, where she keeps asking what's wrong and then trying to guess what's wrong. But we also know she's right, that there is something wrong. So there's this weird validation, but she's also, you know, he cheated on you again. Is it this indictments? Johnny Boy could handle it, but Tony can't. And like all these great little like lines. And of course, when it cuts to her, we see the back of the paper. She is reading the obituaries. Still in her room, and it
like
is
AJ with the fly. Still,
it is interesting that in all these episodes, she seems to act nicer to the family. Even though, I mean, she's being Livia, but it doesn't seem as combative. Like she seems to be like, even when Carmilla comes in, when she tries to say she's asleep, and she's like, "Oh, I thought you were this lady," and you know, of course, she has some comment about her. But on the inside, we kind of know that, I don't know if this is a weird way to lull them into a false sense of security, because, you know, by the end of this episode, she's dropping bombshells.
Yeah, although maybe I'm underestimating her, but I also didn't consider that as much of a bombshell from her, because I think she really believes Tony's just talking shit about his mother. Although I guess she does say, Oh, I don't want any consequences. Yeah. And it's like, well, you're saying that to Junior. Junior's the guy who, when Tony says, like, but you wanted us to do this, right? He was like, yeah, I want to do that. And you're saying, like, but don't do any consequences. So clearly she is doing shit. That's true. But I also suspect that she's just way more happy in this place than she was before and doesn't want to admit it.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we've seen as she's grown accustomed to this place. So maybe that's part of what softened her a bit. A very small bit, but a bit. Now, what I thought was going to happen was they got her out of there so Tony could go in and sweep for bugs. And I'm honestly, like, so, like, you know, I've heard an FBI special agent talk about what bugs can be bugs, and like anything can be a microphone, I've heard, and so on. So maybe it was different 19 years ago, but I really thought even them having a conversation in Christopher's car where they're talking about killing people, I'm like, well, shouldn't you all shut the fuck up about everything all the time now? And like, probably your mother's place is bugged too. I thought Tony was going in to sweep it, but no, he's going in to hide guns and money in there.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Here's a nice hat box. You can fit a bunch of money in here. Here's a garment box. We could stash some shotguns and Uzis underneath the towels. I guess I understand the thinking. Who's going to search a poor little old lady's home?
Well, the FBI would. There's a scene, a short scene, where Tony talks to Melfi about how he might go away to vacation, and he might not. You never know. And they're doing this thing that he's also done with Meadow, where they both know what they're talking about. They're just saying different words because she's kind of sits up straight. So like, am I to understand that you're going on a vacation maybe? And he's like, yeah, maybe. Like, they both know what they're talking about. They're just wrapping it up a bit.
Yeah. Keeping it nice and vague, but it's very clear what's going on, and just giving her the heads up. with these indictments coming down, he doesn't know if he can stick to his schedule. You know, maybe unforeseen circumstances may keep him from showing up at an appointment, and that maybe might play into it later on in this episode.
Maybe. So we get to the scene from our intro this week. What made you choose this one, or what made it one of your favorites of the show?
I just like how it really spells out Christopher, and to tie it back, like, because one of my favorite things about Christopher is the Hollywood stuff and wanting to write a script, and I mean, I could relate to it, obviously, because I mean, I'd like to write a script, I like to make movies, and I like that in his thing, and I think that's it's the, kind of the thing for anyone that wants to make a movie or go out and do whatever creative, is he describes it's because he loves movies. You know, that smell of Blockbuster, I get high off of it. But sometimes just loving movies clearly isn't enough. But I like that, you know, he's kind of picking up stuff from the little bits he's reading about writing a story and writing a script and character arcs, and then it's just making him more depressed because he realizes, like, his movie... his life, his movie called Life, isn't all that it's cracked up to be. And I like Paulie's just kind of like, yeah, so what? Yeah. Who cares?
Yes, I love Paulie's part of the conversation more because he's the one saying that stuff. He's saying, you know, yeah, you know, he says, what if I'm nobody or I'm nothing or whatever? And he's like, yeah, I'm nothing. I'm just half a wise guy. Went to a war, right? He's talking about Vietnam or something.
Well, yeah, he's like, you know, did a couple of years in the army, a couple of years in the can, and here I am, half a wise guy.
Yeah. And I love that part. But, I mean, I can also obviously, like, relate to wanting to write and make films. I have a BA in script writing for television and movies. If anyone wants to hire me, please, oh, God, just send me a check. I'll write whatever. I'll peddle your commercials. I don't care. So, I mean, I feel him. Like, this is something we've experienced, all of us. But I think it's a timing thing for me where, you know, I'm watching this post-Community. Everything is so meta now. Mm. People are always talking about the thing they're in to a point where I've grown to, like, move away from that because it feels so on the nose. And I realize it probably wasn't as on the nose when you watched the show originally or when it was made. But just for me personally, I made a sketch when I was 18 or 19 that was all about talking about writing the sketch that we were doing the sketch of, and the sketch is called Meta, and it's all about, you know, all that stuff. It's not, that's a comedy thing, and this is a dramatic thing, and there's something about it that makes it hard for me to take the drama seriously because it pulls me out of it, because I've seen so many people do that. That's not to say they're not doing it well, but just naturally him talking about, like, where's my character arc? Like, I still... understand, and we have felt like that, and I've said shit like that in real life without being in a movie or anything. You know, I want to have a story of my life. I want to feel like I'm doing something. So it all makes sense, but it didn't quite hit for me.
I get that criticism, but I don't think it's quite the same. I don't think this is the same in a meta sense as something like Community. Although I do agree that it's probably better of the time. Where there's things that are more a little bit self-referential, but I don't see this as meta like that, because, you know, that's like saying a movie about, I mean, I guess it kind of is, like a movie about a writer just is automatically meta because he's a writer in a story, just because he's more, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but I just don't see it the same way as that, and I think it makes more sense just from a character standpoint than it is at some sort of, like, meta commentary on... Like, I see more the Melfi stuff as like, something more in line with Community than what Chris is going through.
Yeah, and to clarify, I guess I don't really think it's similar to Community. It's more that I've just been made too hypersensitive to that type of thing, where I've been overly inundated with people... in a script talking about a script while writing a script in a thing. And I know it makes sense for the character because he's writing this thing and because he's dreaming of being somewhere else and he wants to be somebody and have an arc and get somewhere. So it all makes sense. Yeah. The fault is on my end fully, I think, in this.
Yeah, well, yeah, you're right. No.
Thanks. Cool. But it is, I love all of Polly's input. And I also got to say, I mean, we haven't seen much of Polly, but I like him here. Like, I've mainly seen him talking about how upset he is about Italian-Americans and their cultural appropriation with coffee and Starbucks. Like, that's the thing I saw from him previously. Mm-hmm. So this is a more dramatic scene for him. And I love the way it's lit and put together. The music is kind of different from what we usually get here in the background, and it gives it almost a noir sense of talking in shadows, smoking a cigarette, and I didn't get the sense that these two had any type of relationship other than, that kid, what a fuck up. That's the relationship I imagine everyone having with Christopher. But it's all, yeah, they have like a nice connection, it seems like, talking about these things, even though he's saying, like, yeah, you're an idiot, that's fine, but, you know. So I did like the scene.
Yeah, no, and I get what you're saying. I think especially in a 2018 standpoint, like you said, not necessarily that it has to be community, that's just a great example for something that constantly did references, but
yeah,
I get what you're saying. This is a more common thing you've seen now, and it doesn't ring as fresh or as true. I do like it as another element of, even just whether it's him writing a script or just anything, it's another symbol of maybe there's a better life than this, similar to what we saw from Tony in the last episode of, you know, the what if, and, you know, am I destined to just be a wise guy or half a wise guy, as Paulie would put it. Whereas, you know, like we said, we'd all watch these movies and we're like, yeah, hell yeah, I'd like to do that. I'll clip someone, I'll whack them. And then you see the glitz and glamour. But of course, living that life and having to deal with it, you know, sometimes you dream for something else. So I think it all ties in with that as well and works pretty well.
Yes. And regardless of what I felt about the arc, character arc talk, it's worth it just to have Pussy deliver the line of, like, you know who had an arc? Noah. And then he laughs at his own joke while Christopher is just
another strange transition as well, which I guess to me anyways, it works a little bit better than some of the transitions in the last episode, although still probably a seemingly kind of out of place as far as in the show, because they're talking and then it's just like the camera swipes and now it's like the same conversation, but with Big Pussy, because he even mentioned, like, he talks about the nightmares, but then he brings up the arc part. So we're like, oh, okay, so Christopher just said this whole thing again to Pussy. So Christopher is kind of like a hack character in his own script.
that's true. I was a bit almost disoriented by that one, because it cuts into the middle of that conversation. I don't know if they intended it like this or if they were just like, well, we don't really need to have Polly say, hey, you should talk to Pussy about that. Like, it's not a good end of a scene. So either way, I mean, it kind of works. As you said, it's a bit different from what they usually do. And as is when they're digging up the body, when they cut to the face, the beard, and the fingernails that are growing, like, those cuts are almost reminiscent of last episode, cutting in quick clips of this and that. But it, you know, makes more sense to me here.
The one thing I wonder with that, though, I have to wonder if there was some weird note on that, because it feels like it was either they cut away fast because it looked so fake, or someone said, like, we can't have these lingering shots on a dead body.
But it's HBO.
I know it's HBO, but you still hear that there's still going to be weird notes, even on a show, because it's The Sopranos isn't The Sopranos yet. You know what I mean? And HBO, as far as original programming, also isn't quite HBO yet, given they did have Oz and there was like rape scenes and stuff like that. But I don't know. It did feel a little off to me that I wonder if there was a little bit more there as far as the discussion around it. Because, I mean, we even heard, even though David Chase won the battle, like we discussed in the college episode, they were trying to tell him that Tony shouldn't kill the guy at the end of the episode. So, you know, I don't
know.
That
said, they do show it, like, and I think making it a short clip almost adds to the shock factor or like it's like jumps out in your face. So I think it makes sense in the editing anyway.
Yeah.
Even if maybe they were like, hey, can you try doing that shorter? And if that's what someone did, it worked out fine because it's effective, I think. And it is quite creepy when they find just like a cloth or whatever and move it aside and it's his dead mud face down there. And all the while, I'm thinking, like, I'm so glad in the car scene later when Tony says all the stuff we're thinking of, like, oh yeah, now that you know you're being tailed and followed, let's go dig up a corpse. Yeah. Like, no one's going to notice this shit. Like, Tony says, that's what you do if you want to get caught.
Well, and they show Chris's delusion so perfectly because he goes, let's get this body out of here before they build a condo. And it's such a funny line because they're under a bridge near the water. Like, you could see the water and swamp and everything. Yeah. And then clearly nothing's going to be built there. I love how in his, like, he is in a movie. He's the gangster in a movie, and his dreams are telling him he made a mistake, and oh no, they're gonna build a condo on this swamp marsh under a bridge.
Yes. And then we have Melfi and her ex talking about selling some land. And they're arguing about Tony, I guess. That's the main thing going on in this scene. Which, I like, who cares what her husband thinks? I guess it's all to add some doubt, because she seems like she doesn't have any doubts or anything until Tony does his, I'm going to say, 10th? Yay! Storming out of the office. We don't really have a counter yet. We're working on it.
Someone's got to go back and get the updated count, though.
Yeah, we got to get that down. But he does storm out later and is more aggressive towards her than previously. I guess this is to seed her doubts, because no one really cares what her ex thinks, right?
Yeah, it's a very clunky scene, and it's brought up. Tony's brought up in a very clumsy way as well. And it feels it's also, even though I think this is a very well done episode, it's kind of like, you know, what a great connection scene to scene. Christopher mentions building a condo. Smash cut to Melfi and her ex talking about land they were going to build something on. Like, you know what I mean? Mm. It's such a flimsy, weird connection. But, you know, someone was like, that's it. That's what we need. And, yeah, because they're just talking about this life they were going to have, and now they're going to sell this land. And then out of nowhere, she's like, my client, what, you're just jealous of my client. And again, even though I said I liked the earlier scene, some of this stuff gets, even in their therapy scene, when it comes up again, it feels like they're constantly talking about this. And I guess,
yeah,
in a way,
I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
That, like, oh, they can't talk about anything else. Because I'm glad to see her in a different element. We get to see a different side of her character, but they're still just talking about Tony, patient X.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess in a way it would be a big deal, especially if it was kind of everyone's living their life, but it's a mainstay on the news. Like, you're living in Jersey and it's a big deal right now, so it's kind of front of conversation, but it still feels a little clumsy.
Yeah, and they're all therapists, so they don't want to talk about anything else. Then it's the car scene where Christopher picks up Tony, and he yells at him a bunch, as he should, because he's found out about everything going on, shooting a guy in the foot, then going to dig up the corpse. And I guess the turning point here is where he starts talking about how he thinks he has cancer or something bad building inside his body, and they do it very well. Because Tony obviously recognizes this, and he nudges him towards maybe doing something about his mental health, but he backs off because he can't admit that he's doing that himself.
Yes, yeah, it's such a great scene, and we see that Tony has picked up some things from therapy, and yeah. You know, he obviously can relate to some of the signs he's seeing in Christopher, as far as, you know, he wants to sleep all day, he doesn't feel like his life's worth anything. And it's tough because, yeah, he can't bring up the truth. And also, Christopher's making these, like, macho comments about, like, taking Prozac and stuff. And clearly, Tony will take that as a, you know, like a small little jab at him because he's taking Prozac. And I love when he brings up the suicide and then they both laugh about it.
Yeah.
And it's such a clear indicator they both have thought about killing themselves.
Yep.
And they're like, yeah, how fucking pathetic, right? And they're like, yeah, fucking fuck them. It's handled so well and says so much about both characters. And, you know, if you relate it to nowadays, the big one of the big topics is toxic masculinity. And it's a nice, I guess, play on that, because outside of just being two mafiosos, it could just be two construction workers that are afraid to kind of talk about their feelings to each other, you know?
Yes. And I don't want to generalize, but it does seem to me in both media and in real life that the people who are most opposed to therapy, the idea of it, of letting someone poke around in their head, that's kind of a defense that you build up because you really, really need to do that a lot. And there could be people who are so completely, totally against it, who then later are very zen because they at one point realize they need to go and do that and sort out their shit, when it eventually gets to a point where it's so bad that you gotta deal with it somehow. And again, I don't want to like outright try to predict what's going to happen, and I know you can't comment on it, but this feels like an important scene in that Tony might look back on this later and think, yeah, if I had pushed him in that direction, he A, wouldn't have gotten himself killed, or killed himself, or, I don't know, got himself caught, whatever. Like, if he had pushed harder then, if he had been able to make himself vulnerable, which he should be able to do if he was totally okay with who he was, he shouldn't care what Christopher thinks about him, right? Because Christopher is an idiot. He's his soldier, but he does care. He can't say, shut the fuck up, Prozac's great. Like, he can't do that because he isn't totally confident in that himself. But if he did, I don't know. I feel like this was a point where he should have, because things are going really bad for Christopher and he's heading in the wrong direction and Tony doesn't quite manage to steer him right.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I think that's a great read, and obviously I have no comments.
Yeah, obviously. but it's also a great scene because, I mean, much more so than the dream, we get to see him, like, we peer into his mind even more, even though we're not quite like literally in his mind as we were in the dream, but we peer into it here through the magic of acting, the dream of acting. He does a good job and they both do a good job, and Tony being so rattled that he tries to smoke the cigarette backwards, that's silly, but it works because of the scene and how they act it. Like, someone could write that in a script and it could be stupid, but it's not. It makes sense. And we peer into his mind and see all the messed up stuff going on, and it's captivating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And yeah, it is such a silly moment. And then the fact that he gets so mad that he did it, that he throws the cigarette on the floor and stomps it into the car. And you kind of know Christopher almost wants to say something because that's his like Lexus or whatever. But yeah, what a well thought out, easily to fuck up moment that I completely agree that they'd nail it.
Yes. And next we have the FBI actually knocking on the door, and then, you know, knocking on the garden door because he wasn't quick enough because AJ was playing his video games again. So they come around the back, and the main FBI guy is actually being quite nice and reasonable. And I was literally thinking the same thing that Tony says at the start of the next scene, where, like, yeah, he's the guy you want to watch out for. You don't got to watch out for the guy who, like, breaks a glass and then he's like, hey, you criminal. Like, you got to watch out for the guy who's like, sir, if you'll just take a moment to talk to your kids, we'll give you that, but we don't want to break this door down. He's the smooth talker. He's the dangerous, smart one. And that's exactly what Tony says at the start of the next scene, which I thought was pretty fun.
Oh, yeah, with Agent Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, they break the bowl, and quite reasonably, like, we're not cleaning that up. And there's a conflict there, and Agent Harris sort of mitigates the situation and everything.
Yeah, and Tony says something about up your ass or whatever in Italian to Agent Grosso, who broke the plate. And yeah, then we kind of cut to them. They're having dinner. I believe they're having Chinese food. And we hear a similar discussion where it's kind of, and it's also, you know, a nice echo of Livia when Tony was a kid talking about Johnny Boy and how they just arrested his dad because he's Italian. They picked him up because they don't like Italians. I think even his dad says it. And now he's saying the same thing to his kids. And they start bringing up like Sacco and Vanzetti. And he does mention that they talk about like great Italians in history. Antonio Meucci. Antonio mm-hmm. Meucci invented the telephone. Everyone knows that. And yeah. I don't think everyone knows that. Looking it up real quick, it does show that Antonio Meucci, he began developing a design of a talking telegraph or telephone in 1849. He filed a caveat, which is an announcement of invention for his designs of the talking telegraph. But due to hardships, he could not renew his caveat. His role in the invention of the telephone was overlooked until the United States House of Representatives passed a resolution in June 2002. Most likely prompted by this Sopranos episode, I imagine, because that's like 2 years later or almost True. 3 years after it aired. So yeah, there you go. And it's great. Again, I mean, this is pretty meta as well, but I do love that just the hypocrisy at on display here. But it feels very genuine at the same time, which is weird.
Yes, and I mean, this is the third, I guess, since you brought up last episode in the flashback, the third dinner scene where they're talking about Italian-Americans and their portrayal in the media, and you're right, this is more community-ish than the whole script thing when you think about it, like, not in a disturbing way or anything, but yeah, they're talking a lot about how they're, you know, racist towards Italians, and... you're right. That's more hip these days to say that one thing or another in the media is sort of making people think something about some group of people, even if it isn't like a strictly racist portrayal. Like thinking more about how each portrayal and like cements ideas in the minds of the viewers, even though it doesn't mean to. And yeah, but like I guess the way The Sopranos gets away with it, in quotes, is that they discuss this stuff constantly in the show. They don't just play it straight. They comment on their own show, and again, not in an intrusive way. Like it makes sense that they would have these conversations.
Yeah, I agree. I lost my train of thought, but I was just gonna. I was trying to look up the invention of spaghetti.
Well, of course you were, Jim. You are Italian. What does this have to do with the show? No, they do talk about it. But I guess they mean noodles, right? Because I'm sure... I mean, let's just assume the Chinese had noodles before the Italians had spaghetti. Like, that's... I just assume the Chinese did everything. Maybe that's my own cultural bias. But...
Well, popular history says it was invented in China and Marco Polo brought the knowledge of this food to Venice. The spaghetti Polo encountered and presumably tasted in the Far East was made from either rice flour or hard wheat flour. It was generally accepted that the variety of durum wheat known in Sicily during the Middle Ages was like lemons and oranges introduced by the Arabs. They're going really deep. But
this is why you come to Cut to Black every yeah. Sunday live after you're watching The Sopranos, because you got to know who actually invented the spaghetti. But it's very important.
If you dig a little deeper, because early in 1154, shortly before the death of Sicily's monarch, King Roger II, and about a century before even the birth of Marco Polo, a court chronicler and geographer named Abul Abdullah Muhammad al-Adrisi completed a detailed geographical survey of Sicily. We know much of our knowledge of the economy there. So
please. Just has to end.
Yeah, okay. Jim. Yeah, you're right. So let's just go with Tony. Think about it. How are people going to create spaghetti when they eat with sticks? Are you serious?
Right, because you could never pick up noodles, for example, with sticks. That's a silly. But Meta also asks, who invented the mafia? Oh. And that's kind of a challenge. Kind of like, what are you talking about? Got something you want to say to me? And I think she says, I just like history, like you, Dad. Yeah, I like history like you too, Jim. Just not as much, apparently.
Yeah, and it's a nice kind of update to show us that, like, because kind of the last we've seen of Meadow and Tony is they were on this great college trip. And, you know, they were kind of being honest with each other and they had an understanding. But, you know, as is known with parents and kids and fathers and daughters, there's some time has passed and maybe it's not so copacetic.
Yeah, and to be fair... if someone came in and took my computer away just because of what my dad does for a living, I might give him a little light ribbon too.
And yeah, and then so and then we go into, like you'd mentioned, this is, we got to get the walkout, we need the counter, and we can't wait much longer because then we'll have too many episodes to go back through. But yes, we get another walkout, and this one a bit more combative because I mean, how did you read this? Is it just that Tony's under a lot of stress that he lashes out the way he does?
I mean, that's obviously part of it, but I think also kind of the comparison he makes, would it be all right if I got hit by a car? Like, then would I have to pay? Because he sees it as, it wasn't my fault that I wasn't here. Like, it wasn't a vacation, and we both know it wasn't a vacation. Where when she refuses, he sees that as, oh, you're saying that what's happening to me is my own fault. That's how I read it.
Well, I think that's a great read because it's also true. I mean, it is his fault, but yeah, it's perfectly understandable for what we know of Tony or anyone that would be in this line of business that to them it's not their fault. It's just the stupid cops trying to catch me doing my crime.
Yeah, exactly. Those bastards. And obviously we, like, relate, even though we're not criminals, obviously.
Yeah. And yeah, he stands up and he starts throwing money and he says, like
a rapper.
Yeah, and he's like, this is what it's all about, huh? Motherfucking cocksucking money. And I guess there's also an element that, you know, he feels like they have this understanding and this relationship, and now it is being brought down to just a financial transaction. Obviously, I'm not saying he's reacting well to that, but it is a weird reminder that you're paying me here to try to just listen to your bullshit, but I mean to try to help you as well.
Yeah, I don't appreciate feeling like I'm pouring my heart out to a call girl. Which is a bit rude. I mean, it's her job. Like you know, like how murdering peoples and extorting peoples is your job. What if people didn't pay you? But yeah, it's a bit. I think mainly it's, you know, being literally, like, hunted by people doesn't put you in a mood to be very understanding anyway. So I think any little thing probably would have set him off. We would have gotten a ding on that counter no matter what, I think. Also, great suit, Tony, in that scene. He doesn't usually wear something as extravagant there in therapy.
Yeah, he's really living it up. Shown as all about appearances. And then we get
there's
this.
Yep, go ahead.
Well, I was going to move to the next scene, but you go ahead.
Well, I was going to move to the next scene by saying that we've all done rough gigs, right? Like, we've all had a hard time in our, whether it be music, comedy, whatever you do, if you perform in front of people, we've all had tough crowds. But it's hard to compare to the nursery home old ladies in wheelchairs who are only there because someone wheeled them to the location and they're physically unable to move away. I'll say at least they're not talking during your set, well, except a couple in the back there, and someone shushes them even though no one laughs or appreciates what's going on or understands it even. How do you book this gig? Does he get paid? Is it just for his resume? What's going on, Jim?
Well, this scene, and I mean, just rewatching this show, and we've talked a lot about the comedy, and this show is so funny. I forgot how funny it is, and thinking about it now, I mean, because there's obviously the obvious comparison of like Sopranos and Breaking Bad, but I feel like the truer influence on this rewatch is that, yeah, they both have an anti-hero and kind of a character that's doing bad things that we root for. But I feel like the tone of the humor is a much bigger influence I'm seeing that had that affected Breaking Bad more so than just the cool badass main character. Because this scene felt totally like something you'd see in Better Call Saul or Breaking Bad, like almost to a T. And even going back to like Christopher's script and the dumb like typos and how stupid he sounds, but dumb people think it's great, like his girlfriend. That's the thing that's pointing that's like really hitting me hard as I'm rewatching it. And yeah, it's such a funny, great scene with just this lame comedian doing lame jokes, but kind of being annoyed that the old people, like, he's kind of like, ah, this room, it's the room's fault, you know? You get that impression that he's blaming the old people, but he stinks, the crowd stinks. It's such a great environment for this scene to happen.
I mean, I gotta say, he's got a lot of references in his comedy that I don't really follow, so I would probably, even if I was in there, young, hip, 20-something that I am, I'd fit right into that crowd. I wouldn't be like, oh, so true! Like, I would also be that guy. But hey, it's the room. It'll affect you. On a surface level, it's similar to Better Call Saul, obviously, because the previous season, if you're not watching Better Call Saul, it was a lot of Saul in an old folks' home, and basically standing in front of them, talking and saying fun stuff, not getting a reaction, and sort of playing off it. So obviously, on a surface level, it's very reminiscent. But on more of the content level, as you were saying, it's the tone of it, which goes throughout, of having these fun, silly things, but then also weaving in the drama and making both work. That's also my favorite type of show, where you can have the comedy and you can have the drama, and they don't do battle against each other. They can actually help enhance one another. And I agree with what you said.
Absolutely. And yeah, this is where we have Livia kind of filling in Junior on the psychiatrist. And then Junior's just still, like, it's similar to, I guess, when Livia first heard. Yeah. He's like a psychiatrist?
Intentionally, yeah. Like the same, I think. Because they're making him look like AJ, or like, yeah, making that. That's the type of mental connection they have, the same as her with her grandson, of like repeating it over and over. And even having to do the thing we mentioned of hitting it on the head of like, oh, who knows what he says to her, that person, even though he just said like, I think we got a bad apple or whatever. And he's like, well, you know, Tony sees a psychiatrist apropos of nothing.
Yeah, that's why I think there's a little bit more malice there. I do agree with you to a point where, I mean, she does even specifically say, I don't want any repercussions, but she knows what she's doing. She is planting this seed, and, you know, maybe she can water it over time and it can grow to some great drama. But right now, yeah, she's bringing it up because, yeah, she's personally hurt because, of course, it's all about her. But she also is aware because, like you said, Junior does bring up a bad apple, kind of alluding to that someone might be talking. And that could be, I mean, if you hear that someone's going to a psychiatrist, you can't trust this person who's outside of this thing of ours.
Yeah. What do you, I guess I can't really ask, but I wonder what he means or what he's heard or what's made him think that, if it's just the situation or like that they're being investigated and he's like, probably someone's talking, or if he's like got a reason, like, because obviously Christopher's a bad apple, he's acting like a bad apple in this episode with all the dumb shit he's doing. So is it that? And especially if you link it to you did murder his friend earlier, so maybe that could be a potential bad apple. Or maybe it's, you know, the bartender who is clearly an FBI undercover agent. I don't know.
All great variables. And now you know what it's like to be in the mob. You're always looking over your shoulder. Even your best friend, you can't trust him.
Yeah, exactly. So she lays, it's like she hammers it home pretty hard. What does she want? Like, does she want them to kill each other? Like, where is her heart? Does it exist? I don't know. Like, it hasn't gotten that far yet, but I guess it feels like she just wants to, like, oh, I just want to annoy my son. And then when I get annoyed at Junior, I want him to annoy Junior. And like, does she just want the drama? Does she forget that these people murder people over shit like this? I don't know if she wants them dead, or like how twisted she's gotten in her bitterness.
I mean, yeah, it's hard to say, and especially it's especially interesting when you hear that David Chase based this character mostly on his own mother. So, I mean, who knows what a treat she was? Apparently,
I like that, Olivia. She gets shushed, and she kind of shushes, she quiets down, which I honestly, it's hard for me to imagine that she would, like she would like shush you back or whatever, but it's like she feels like, yeah, we shouldn't be talking about this, or I don't know exactly.
Yeah, we should be respecting the comedy. We should be respecting the show.
So we have the scene where The therapist talks to Melfi and her son and ex-husband, which apparently he's at college somewhere, I gather, and apparently everyone's just got time to get together to go to therapy. I don't know if their son has had kind of issues. They hint that he's had problems or something that's enough for them to like, okay, for him, we'll pull together and go and do this thing. But they're just there talking about Tony still and about like, oh, my ex is obsessed with my patient. That's like something you go to Dr. Phil with, I guess. But it's like you said, that's like, is this all you can talk about? Is this really like your son doesn't have any actual issues? Because it's like, how do you feel about your mother's patient ex? It's like, who gives a shit? Which is basically what he says, because he seems like the only sane person in the room.
Yeah. And I don't know if it is like a weird comment on. Yeah. Like she's a psychiatrist. Did they say that her ex is also a psychiatrist? I forget what his occupation is. So yeah, it is kind of such this weird cliche where they're like, well, of course we should go as a family and see a family therapist as well. And they are vague purposely on whatever the issues are, which could lead you to easily believe that it's probably not a big deal, but they're such like therapy, therapy, therapy. And so here they are discussing like kind of nonsense. And I do love that moment when the ex-husband is like, would you like to see your mother? Oh, forget it. I'm not going to paint that picture. And it's like, you know, that's painting a way worse picture than whatever you would have said. And, you know, the son does comment on it like he always does this. And it does feel like such a real interaction between. You know, you get the sense that they do all love each other, but clearly the marriage didn't work, but they're on good terms. They're having dinner and stuff, but there's this weird bickering and back and forth. And if they are therapists, they're like also diagnosing each other's, you know, ailments and how they argue. So it seems like such a nightmare.
Yeah, we're moving even further into Woody Allen territory with the therapy and stuff going on here. And he starts talking of like, almost unprompted, he brings up, you know, on my mother's side, we had a few dark sheep ourselves. But he's literally bragging about it. And he's like laughing like, those were some hard-ass Jews or whatever he says. And they're just looking at him.
Well, even when, and then he makes that joke, like some awful joke about, you know, maybe describe him like a mob with depression doctor. And he laughs really hard and everyone's staring at him. He's just clearly such an inappropriate family therapist.
I wonder as well, because we know Melfi goes to therapy from the recent investigation into her life from the crooked cop. So I wonder if this is the therapist she goes to. I don't doubt that she knows at least, you know, a dozen other therapists that she could go to. But I know it's part of the rules, at least as far as psychoanalysis, you're supposed to also go see someone if you're doing the job. Like, you have to unload your shit in order to help others unload their shit. And I wonder if it's this guy or if they have, like, a dedicated family therapy guy. And if so, why is it this guy? Because he doesn't seem that good at it.
Is that really a rule? I did not know that.
Well, I know it's a rule here, at least, as far as, I mean, probably not every type of therapy, but that's, I was interested in becoming a psychologist at one point. And that's honestly, this ties into what I was saying before. The people who are most against therapy are probably the people who most need it, because I was like, but that would mean someone would poke around in my brain. I don't really want that. I just want to poke around in other people's brains. And then I was like, wait a minute, I clearly shouldn't be a psychiatrist or psychologist.
Well, you did a good job of diagnosing yourself there and that in making those choices. So maybe you would be a great psychiatrist.
Yeah, either one. Not too late. So this brings us to the end of the episode. These blank stares that end the scene. And then we get to Christopher fucking finally gets what he wants. Like, his arc is getting there. He is in the newspaper as a suspect who might go to jail for a long time because he did the crimes he did. So he's thrilled about that, obviously.
Yeah, he's awoken from his, you know, depression. Like, he's just laying in bed in his messy apartment, and he gets a voicemail from his mother, who's kind of, you know, she's annoyed. She's like, what's going on? I heard from the neighbors. You're in the paper. But to him, this is a great thing. This is what he's been looking for. Finally, he's getting some credit where credit's due. And yeah, we get a nice ending scene where he goes and buys a paper, finds his name, and then he steals every other paper in there as well. And I like the cake song that they end the episode on. The song's called Frank Sinatra. And that's who Tony... I had to look this up. I didn't know this. Because at the end of the scene when the Sopranos are having dinner, talking about Italians, and he says, of course, there's also Frank Albert. And that's Frank Sinatra. I did not know that.
I also literally Googled Frank Albert and Frank Sinatra came up. So, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the end of the episode. And it really feels like they're, you know, upping the pace. As I said, it feels like they kind of bring something up and then let it simmer while they deal with another story. And then they pop back up and hit you hard with it the next time. So I don't even know. It almost feels like if that pattern holds, next week we won't have, you know, Junior going to jail, but, you know, Junior will be indicted or arrested in two episodes if that theory holds. But we'll see. I mean, it's obviously shit is happening, which I do appreciate as far as the momentum and speed and how many episodes are left in the season.
Yeah, I think we're in a good place, and things are, you know, hey, it's an HBO show. We're coming up on almost the end of the season, kind of. I mean, we have, what, one, two, three, four, well, still five episodes, but still. Things about to ramp up and lead towards that finale, so hop on board, people.
Yeah, I can't wait to be a rebellious teenagers. Now, I did want to mention this at the top of the show, but I forgot. But I did want to spotlight and thank the people who have left reviews on our iTunes feed.
Yes.
You can find it by searching for Cut to Black, A Soprano Sit Down on iTunes or your podcaster of choice, where you can leave a review. Let us know if you've done that, and we'll include it in the show. Like, for example, Couch Diet wrote, "Excellent choice, sir. One of the best podcasts on the best shows in existence. One of the best shows. I recommend it with a side of gabagoo." And that was from the title was Beautiful Moi. And then there's El Notorious One, who did a review called Best Show, which I shall guess that he's talking about us and not The Sopranos, hopefully both. Jim and Jacob are able to break down TV shows with humor and insight that are unmatched by any TV podcast out there. Throw in a show completely dedicated to breaking down every episode of my favorite show, The Sopranos, and you get one of the most enjoyable podcasts around. I highly recommend this for any Sopranos fan and also for those who haven't watched The Sopranos. So basically everyone, thank you for including that. Go week by week with the guys, and you won't be disappointed on either front. Also, check out their other podcast, Shows What You Know. These two make magic together. Keep up the great work. That's from Tony. Thank you.
What a great review. And yeah, I completely forgot that we should tell people to review the show on the Cut to Black feed. That is greatly appreciated. Trying to get as many ears and eyes on the show as possible.
Yes, and it is true that we have another show called Shows What You Know at showswhatyouknow.com, which is also where the show is hosted, so you probably have heard of it or seen it, perhaps. We discuss other television shows, and you can recommend a show for us to watch by leaving a review on that feed. And we hope you stay tuned. We are trying to hammer down a time of when we are streaming exactly. We do these live streams on our YouTube, youtube.com/showswhatyouknow, and it's been on Sundays. Every Sunday since we started Sopranos, so it almost should have been called, you know, Sopranos Sundays Dinner or Sunday Sit Down, whatever you have you. But it's been on Sundays around noon PST, Pacific Standard Time. That's 9 in Sweden, 8 in the UK. And if you just go there, it'll pop up. Or check our Twitter, which is at Shows What You Know, but the U is the letter U.
All kinds of great information. Download that to your brains. Download the show. Tell a friend. And then the most important thing
is to go to awesomepedia.org and jimandthem.com for our other content.
Nope. You know what the most important thing is?
Oh, what is it?
Cut to Black.